Mr. End.
Thank you. May it please the court. Karen Bambachi was subjected to severe and pervasive sexual harassment by coworkers for approximately 2.5 years. That's undisputed for today. The issue today is notice. And there are three areas I want to highlight to the court to show that there is a genuine issue of material fact as to whether the company had notice. First, there is evidence that Sarah Stoll, an employee of the company, told the plant manager well before March 2001 that Karen Bambachi was being sexually harassed. It's undisputed that the company contends it had no notice and therefore they could not have taken appropriate measures to correct the harassment that Mr. Creasy knew about well before March of 2001. Second, the circumstances of the harassment in light of where the harassment occurred and the obviousness of the harassment, it constitutes constructive notice, and also there is an inference that can be drawn that the plant manager, whose office was just 10 yards away from where the harassment occurred, did in fact know of the harassment but chose to ignore it.
Now, what was the evidence in support of that, Mr. Ann? I understand the physical proximity, but what do we have in addition to the physical proximity?
Well, we have...
We have a closed door, right? I mean, there's not a visual connect, is there?
There is a visual connect. The door had a large window, which almost took up the half of the entire door. Through that window, Mr. Creasy could view the press room floor where the joggers and pressmen worked. That was undisputed by JCPG. So we have a supervisor, the plant manager, with a window, which presumably is so he can supervise his employees, and the harassment occurred right outside that window.
So is it his failure to patrol the area that's the gravamen of what you suggest here?
Well, there are two inferences that can be made. One is that he, in fact, did know about it, not his failure to patrol it.
By proximity.
Right. The obviousness of it, going back to Farmer and Brennan, the U.S. Supreme Court. Second is if, in fact, he played the ostrich-like role and buried his head in the sand, that he should have known about it. He should have looked out that window and noticed this harassment that occurred on an almost daily basis for 2.5 years. The other co-workers witnessed it. This was on the public press room floor. This wasn't an incident where the sexual harassment occurred in a private office. It didn't occur on an internet screen. This was open. Other co-workers saw it. So I think
the record reflect any the extent of contact between Ms. Bambachi and Mr. Creasy during the work period?
Well, the record shows that Mr. Creasy spent much of the day in his office. And Ms. Bambachi did have some contact with him. I know the record shows that she periodically was in his office when Sarah Stoll was absent. She might insert some information on the computers.
So she had access to Mr.
She did have access to Ms. She did. Yes, she did. And in light of also the deliberately exhibitionist type of harassment, the men putting things between their legs, picking her up on their shoulders, yelling, screaming, that you can basically infer that he did know about it or should have known about it. And that's the second part of our argument showing that the company did have notice. And the third part is that Karen Bambachi reasonably believed that Sarah Stoll was the appropriate point person designated by the company to channel the complaints of sexual harassment. Under the company's policy, she was able to complain to a manager or a supervisor. The company policy did not identify who the managers or supervisors were, and the evidence is replete with evidence showing that Sarah Stoll had job duties that extended beyond the normal job duties of a jogger. We know that Karen Bambachi believed she was her supervisor starting from the very first day. We know that Mr. Miller stated that Karen Bambachi reported to Sarah Stoll. One of the other harassers said that he was unsure, he didn't know if Sarah Stoll was a supervisor. And then you also have that memo that was written after all the harassment occurred. And in that memo, the plant manager was trying to clarify concerns that some of the press workers and joggers had as to Sarah Stoll's supervisory authority. And in light of the job supervision and how she directed Karen Bambacci's work, it was reasonable for Karen to believe that she, in fact, was a supervisor who did also, in fact, report it to Jim Creasy, as Sarah Stoll told her that she did.
Was Ms. Stoll a more senior employee?
Ms. Stoll had worked there. She was the people considered her the head jogger. She had worked there since 1993. Ms. Bambacci started in 1998. Sarah Stoll helped in Mr. Creasy's office entering data onto reports. She oversaw payroll by checking to make sure employees clocked in and clocked out. She directed the employees on how to do their work, and she gave she assisted in the scheduling also, and that is undisputed. So it was reasonable for Ms. Bambacci to believe that she was a supervisor who, under policy, has a duty to report this and take some action about the sexual harassment. And those are the three points I would like to make. I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henn. Mr. Goroff?
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. N gives you an inaccurate picture of the record here on some key issues. First of all, with regard to whether Mr. Creasy, who was the actual supervisor, that's undisputed, of Ms. Bambacci, there is an admission by Ms. Bambacci herself, and it's emphasized by the court and set forth in the appendix to Mr. N's brief at page 14 of that appendix, that she knew that Mr. Creasy never observed anything. She admits he didn't see anything. She further admits she never told him. And so all of the discussion of proximity is really irrelevant when we have a record that is very clear, as the court emphasized below, that the supervisor simply didn't know, and the victim here, the plaintiff, did nothing to further that notice. That's very, very clear, and I'll come back to it. And some of what he tells you about proximity is also an inaccurate description of what's in the record. First of all, 10 yards is a long ways away, but as Mr. N tells you, the door was usually closed. Mr. Creasy faced a computer away from the window, didn't look at the window. When the door was closed and the presses were running, and again, it's undisputed that most of these incidents occurred when the presses were running, he could not hear things from the floor. He was, you know, the reason he was a supervisor was to be shielded from that. And he could not see things more than 10 feet away. And the presses that Wampner and Miller were usually assigned to was more than 10 feet away. So all of the facts show that there really is no question of proximity here either.
Are you abandoning proximity as in the sense that it would have been not difficult for Ms. Bambacci to contact Mr. Creasy?
Well, actually, Your Honor, that was my next point, which is to the extent that Mr. Creasy was only a few feet away with a door there, to the extent these things took place when he was there, certainly she could have gone in at any time over a 2.5-year period when these things were happening, and she simply didn't do so. And Mr. End referred to the exhibitionist behavior, but that's simply not what the record shows. Mr. Miller and Mr. Wampner testified that they were on good behavior when Mr. Creasy was, in fact, in his office. And there's no, again, the evidence is clear. We have an admission from Ms. Bambacci that she didn't show. The other issue that Mr. Ann raises is the question of Ms. Stoll and whether she's a supervisor, and there's really no issue there either.
Well, didn't Stoll instruct Bambacci to, I mean, Creasy instructed Bambacci to report to Stoll at the beginning? Stoll trained her, instructed her on a routine basis. She assisted with scheduling, handed out paychecks, kept track of vacation and personal days, worked on reports in Creasy's office 1 hour each day, and reviewed the jogger and press timesheets, informed them when the information was incomplete.
Those are facts that are in the record. Those do not show supervisory authority. Ms. Stoll was essentially performing ministerial activities. With regard to scheduling and with regard to vacations, Ms. Stoll testified and Mr. Creasy confirmed he supervised and approved of everything she did. Her handing out paychecks, her putting names on schedules, her filling out forms of that nature were of a ministerial kind of duty. And Ms. Bambacci testified that she occasionally would perform those duties as well, as would Mr. Hansen when Mr. Creasy was not available. That's not the test of supervisor. The test of supervisor, as this court's Parkins case shows, is a 5-point one. Does the individual in question have the ability to hire, to fire, to discipline, to promote, or transfer? And the facts here are simply not in dispute. Ms. Stoll had no such authority. Rather, Ms. Bambacci admits she knew that Mr. Creasy had that authority. She was told that at the beginning of her employment. There's also the Duvielic.
So you're suggesting that's the only way someone can be a supervisor, that they have the ability to fire. What about the Valentine case?
Well, the Valentine case is one where if they have the ability to transfer. I wasn't saying hire. I said you have to have one of five. And in Valentine, there was an ability to do a certain kind of transfer. There was a contest over whether there was a second kind of transfer that could be done by the corrections officer in Valentine, but not... There was no issue that that individual had some authority to transfer, Judge Williams, and Ms. Stoll simply has no such authority here. And there's not been a case where an individual in Ms. Stoll's circumstances has been found to be a supervisor. You also have the Duvielic case, which says that if you've tried to do something through a channel and it's not working, at some point it is incumbent on an alleged victim to change your strategy. And all that Ms. Bambacci says is that she told Stoll she thought that Stoll would tell Creasy. Mr. Creasy says Stoll never told him. Ms. Stoll says she never told Creasy. There's no dispute. Stoll was never a vehicle for a Journal Community Publishing Company to know. As your honors are aware, the law against sexual harassment is not self-enforcing. In order to have constructive notice, an employee must make a concerted effort. That's the standard set forth in this court's Rhodes case, the Parkins case, and the Hrabowski and Zimmerman cases that Mr. N cites, to advise the employer that she is being harassed. And the information must be one that is of a kind that gives the employer a reasonable belief that the employee is being sexually harassed. We do not have that here. There is an admission Ms. Bambacci never told Creasy anything. As Your Honor, Judge Flom pointed out, the door was nearby. Over 2.5 years, she could have done something. Having not done so, the law is very clear that you cannot, in a case of coworker harassment, which is all we are talking about, impose a violation upon an employer. The Hall case basically says that whereas here the employee foregoes the opportunity to advise her employer that something's wrong, there is no concerted notice. And here there's more than that, because Bambacci was asked at one point about the comment about language that Ms. Stoll made, and she said that nothing is going on. So she blunted and indeed ended any possible investigation Mr. Creasy could have done on his own initiative. So for those reasons, it's a very thorough opinion by the court below that goes through the facts in great detail. It did, as Mr. N said, begin with the assumption that the allegations of Ms. Bambacci are correct as to what she suffered, and it said that that is not enough to impose an obligation on the appellee here, Journal Community Publishing Company, because no notice was given. And we believe that should be affirmed, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Gora. Mr. N.
Can you start with this point that counsel made that Stoll didn't have the ability to transfer or to fire? You know, what's the best case that you have that says that facts, under this type of fact scenario you have, that supports your position?
Well, it's actually Parkins and Young versus Bayer. The five-part test in Parkins is a test as to whether the harasser was a supervisor. The issue why that's important is that if the harasser has the ability to hire, fire, and transfer, then they can use that to gain a power and sexually harass a victim. In this case, the issue is who was the designated channel? Who are the point people designated by the company? The company's policy says managers slash supervisors. It doesn't say who the supervisors are. So if Ms. Bambacci reasonably believed that Sarah Soul was a supervisor, not for Title VII harassment purposes, but just in the general, what would a reasonable...
Go through those factors. Following up on what Judge Williams said, what are the two or three strongest factual indicators that would lead Ms. Bambacci to believe that Ms. Stoll was a supervisor?
The very first day, the plant manager instructed her to report to Sarah Stoll. Sarah Stoll trained her. She continued to instruct
Ms. Would you say she's like a foreperson? Is that the argument?
It's very similar to that, yes. And she handed out paychecks. She did administrative and supervisory functions. She reviewed the payrolls to make sure employees were punching in and punching out. Just because she didn't have the ability to hire and fire her, it doesn't mean that the average employee would believe that she was not her supervisor. Karen Bambacci was told to report to Sarah Stoll, and that's what she did.
I don't know whether the record reflects whether Mr. Creasy had a secretary, but if he had such a person, would that person be an appropriate channel? Is that the same kind of thing? Because some of those duties you're suggesting reflect sort of an administrative aide slash secretary to...
Some of them, but I think what's important is that also she had the duty to direct and instruct on what to do and how to do it. But then when you add the fact that she would be in Mr. Creasy's office entering things on his computer, it kind of gave her an appearance that she was more significant than the average jogger. And just like the two men, they considered her the head jogger.
What's the record reflect, if anything, on the contact between Ms. Bambacci and Mr. Creasy? I don't mean just proximity, but what is her contact point, frequency or whatever?
Yeah, I don't believe the record is real clear on the frequency of conduct, but he was there. He was at the plant most of the time.
Well, why don't you address the argument again that counsel made that, you know, at some point when she wasn't getting relief from Stoll and nothing changed, because we're talking, this isn't like, you know, 30 days over the course of 30 days or 2 months. We're talking 2.5 years. You know, at some point, shouldn't she have gone to Creasy or taken some additional steps? Since she wasn't getting relief from Stoll.
Well, first of all, at some point she did. And second of all, she
was... Right, but this is like after 2.5 years have passed, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, I'm talking about the time between when it began and the 2.5 years when she actually went to Creasy.
Well, she believed that Mr. Creasy knew about it. Sarah Stoll told Karen that she informed Mr. Creasy and instructed him about the sexual harassment.
And is that fact in dispute?
Well, yes, it is in dispute, and I think the jury is going to have to weigh the credibility of the witnesses, and I think that's a genuine issue of material fact, and on that fact alone, that this should get to a jury and summary judgment should be denied. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. N. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.